For nearly all of you listening, your knowledge of Israel begins in Scripture. Your knowledge of Israel is also what you see on television for as many years as the nation of Israel has been an independent state. That's some 66 years going back to 1947. But in our community, we may not know a lot about the nation of Israel, where they're coming from, what are their concerns. And so I got an email a couple of weeks ago from the Midwest Consulate of the nation of Israel, and they said that their consul general was going to be heading to town and wanted to talk to the media. I say, hey, we'll talk to anybody. And so Rory Gilad is the Midwest Council General of the Nation of Israel. He is here in our studio and kind of looking on and watching everything is Lindsay Mintz, and she is the head of the Indianapolis Jewish Community Relations Council. Guys, welcome. Council General, welcome.
Amos, thank you very much for hosting us.
During the break, he was telling me what my first name means because it is one of the prophets of the Old Testament.
In Hebrew, we say Amos.
Amos.
Amos, that's the right way to pronounce your name.
See the things we learn on this.
Never too late.
The things we learn on this program.
Until now, you've been Amos. From now on, you're Amos.
We should tell you that Mr. Gilad is a veteran diplomat for more than a quarter of a century, working on behalf of his nation. He has served his nation and postings in Great Britain, in Jordan.
Indeed.
See, some of y'all didn't think Israel had an embassy in the nation of Jordan, and in Kenya. And he's a veteran diplomat, and since everyone in Israel serves in the armed forces, he was a sergeant in artillery.
That's true.
And I bet you had to fire the doggone thing, too. Did you have to fire in anger?
Yeah, I participated as an active soldier in 1982. This was the first war in Lebanon.
Mm.
I say unfortunately, because in Israel, every few years we have some clash. So this was the only soldier where I was an active, the only war, sorry, where I was an active soldier. By the way, not so many people know, but on top of the 3 years compulsory service that you do, two for women, we keep on doing a reserve for many years. I did it only for 10 years because I was sent abroad as part of my career. But the average citizen in Israel, if he's, let's say he's being drafted at the age of 18, immediately after high school, then he stays at the army until the age of 21. So until the age of usually 40, so about 20 years, he has to sacrifice nearly 1 month every year to go for his army service. So for the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, are leaning on a small part of the army, which are young soldiers that are there for 3 years, but the major part of the army are much older people that they come and go, and they spend each year 1 month in the army.
Let me ask you, what is the biggest thing that Americans misunderstand about your country?
Ah, that's a big question. Amos, you should have told me before that you're going to ask such an existential question. First of all, let me tell you, you spoke about my career. I was an Israeli diplomat in Africa, in the Middle East, which is not easy for us, in Europe. And basically, let me tell you that in America in general and the Midwest in particular, we enjoy more understanding than in other places.
Mm-hmm.
I think this dialogue, this understanding is leaning, first of all, on a very big and significant Jewish community here that is like the bridge between the state of Israel and the United States. It's leaning on a very similar Judeo-Christian tradition. Both states are leaning on the same moral values of democracy, human rights, women rights, freedom of the media, freedom of the opposition, if you want. In that sense, I believe that my challenge here as an Israeli diplomat in the Midwest is less difficult than challenges I had in other places. Yet, there is one thing that I still find it challenging to explain, and this is the depths of the geopolitical challenges that the state of Israel is facing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that Israeli citizens believe that there is, maybe other than the Iranian threat, something we should consider as an existential threat. Israel, again, putting aside the Iranian threat, if you'd like, right. we can speak about it later. Israeli citizens do not believe that their life is in danger. Basically, we face many challenges, but I think we have a significant answer to all those challenges. But living all your life in a situation, this is like a pressure cook, you know, like there is all those pressures around you with the Palestinians and Egypt is falling apart and Syria is falling apart and Iran and you name it. Again, we learn to live under those circumstances, but it creates kind of a pressure that I'm not sure the average American in the Midwest can really identify with it.
Up until Arab Spring, your country and Egypt had peaceful relations. There was a peace treaty. Everybody was, you know, following that. Everybody was behaving themselves. Then there was Arab Spring. Democracy, everybody thought was going to flourish in Egypt. It is, you know, it is chaotic there. You know, is there fear that that country would, you know, break down and then who knows who would run the country?
Well, indeed, the relationship between Israel and Egypt since 1979, this is when we signed the peace accord, the Camp David peace accord. Right. By the way, we have to give credit to President Carter that was the chairman of this peace accord. Since then, actually, this accord was like a cornerstone in our relationship with the Arab world. Mm-hmm. The Jordanians joined in 1994, the Israeli-Jordanian peace accord known as Wadi Arava peace accord was chaired at the time by President Clinton. Again, mm-hmm. he needs to have credit, get to credit for that. We signed an agreement with the Palestinians in 1993. Unfortunately, it didn't develop the way we wanted it to develop. Look, I think the peace accord with the Egyptians, that again, it's like the cornerstone of all those agreements that right. followed, is there. It is solid. It serves the interest, definitely of the interest of Israel, but also the interest of the Egyptians. It serves the interest of the United States. It serves the interest of every party who would like to see peace, tranquility, and stability in the Middle East. For if this agreement goes down, then I really don't see how future agreements can survive.
Palestine and the Palestinians. There are some that are probably listening right now and could identify with the Palestinians, any people who want to run their own country, be responsible for their own affairs. From your government's point of view, what would it take to get to that point where Palestine is its own country, responsible for their own security, their own protection, as well as keep their promises and say, hey, we're going to take care of, you know, our business and we're not going to mess with any of our neighbors?
Amos, as we speak now here in this studio, Israeli and Palestinian representatives are basically engaged in another round of negotiations. Mm-hmm. Our aim is one, to try to reach a final status agreement that is known as the two-nation-state solution. We basically, in other words, we want to divorce from the Palestinians. We cannot live together. Mm-hmm. And this divorce is known as the two-nation-state solution. I say two-nation-state because it has to be clear that when you speak about two states, you don't speak about two Arab states. You talk about a Jewish state mm-hmm. and a Palestinian state. This is our aim. Now, the American broker have set the time limit for those negotiations for 9 months. Maybe they thought about delivery or something. I don't know why 9 months. But since already 4 months out of the nine have passed, we are left with five. If you ask me frankly, only between you and I, our mm-hmm. listeners are not listening, right. The chances to reach a final status agreement that will touch all the five very difficult final status portfolios, Jerusalem, refugees, borders, security, settlements, the chances really to engage and to find a decent solution to all those five portfolios within 5 months from now, I really have my doubts. I believe that if indeed at the end of those 9 months we reach a long, solid interim agreement with the Palestinians that indeed will touch at least two elements of those five, mainly borders and security, borders to give the Palestinian some sovereign entity and security to make sure that this sovereign entity will not eventually intimidate Israel, I think we should be happy. The main challenge, the main reason why I believe we cannot reach currently a final status agreement is, I'm afraid, the huge Palestinian diaspora. You are talking about millions
all
of
across
Palestinian
the Middle East.
Refugees all across the Middle East. The Palestinian leadership, at least this is in Ramallah, the Palestinian Authority, not so much the Hamas, they understand that there is a need for compromise. A solid majority within the Jewish people needs and understands that there is a need for a compromise. We are willing to pull back from most of the West Bank. Are they huge? Is the huge number of Palestinian refugees in the Palestinian diaspora? Abu Mazen is talking about 5 million refugees. Let's say we have less, 3 million. Any number get. Are they willing to give up places they used to live until 1948? Next to Tel Aviv, Jaffa and Ramle and Akko and you name it, and Ashkelon and Haifa. Are they willing to give up the dream? I'm not sure we are there.
239-1310, 239-1310. We're talking to Roei Gilad. He is the Midwest Council General of the Nation of Israel. 239-1310. Let me go to Jeff. Jeff's got a question about what we were just talking about, and that is relationships with Palestine. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing, Amos? And hello to your guests. I too fought in Lebanon in 83 and 84, so I knew I got very firsthand knowledge of what went on over there. But, I'm talking about the Palestinians, not only in the current situation with the Palestinians, but also with Jews who are people of color. And from what I understand, that relationship between the majority of Israelis and its relationship to Jews who are people of color is not very good. And also, what is Israel's relationship with South Africa right now? Because it's pretty well known that Israel was a staunch supporter of the apartheid regime for many years and was very instrumental in keeping President Mr. Nelson Mandela in prison for many years. So what is Israel's relationship with the current South African administration? And what is the end game with the Palestinians? And I want to hear your response about your current relationship with the government of South Africa post-apartheid.
All right, let me start with the bottom of Africa first, and that is South Africa. What is the current relationship with the majority government?
I'll take you by surprise, Jeff. I think Israel made its own mistake with the apartheid regime. Much of it because at the time, because there was a huge Jewish community in South Africa that we had to protect. I'm not sure we did exactly the right thing, but nowadays we definitely work very hard to amend some mistakes that were done in the past. Our relationship with the Republic of South Africa are improving on a daily basis. There's still a lot of work to be done. There is still a lot of bitterness on the other side. But at the end of the day, I believe that the interest of both South Africa and Israel will be served the best once we normalize our relationship, and we are not very far from there.
As I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, anyone who is of the Jewish faith can emigrate to Israel.
Indeed. And this brings me to the second question of Jeff. Everybody of the Jewish faith can immigrate to the state of Israel. This law was established after the Holocaust, after the Jewish Holocaust during the Second World War, when we eventually discovered that Jewish people can live wherever they want, like there are 10,000 of them living in Indianapolis, 20,000 all over Indiana. But if they decide to immigrate to the state of Israel, they don't have to wait any time. They don't have to go through any tests, any examinations. Automatically, they are citizens of the state of Israel with rights and commitments, just like me, that I was born in the state of Israel. Now, as for black Jews, Jeff, here I think you have some, I don't know where the information comes from, but we have many black Jews in Chicago, where I work from. I go to their synagogues. Many of them go to Israel. There is huge communities in Israel of what known as black Hebrews. They come from Chicago. They live in Dimona. They live in Arad. They live in Mitzpe Ramon, which are all of them communities in the south of Israel. We have excellent relationship with them. What might be misleading you is that we have a big problem in Israel of illegal immigration. People, non-Jews, that are coming to Israel and they're not also political asylum, not looking for political asylum as much as looking for work. This is immigration for work. Now we have those people, we have about 250,000 non-legal immigrants in Israel.
So the same kind of immigration problem we have in our country, you have in yours?
Even bigger, because Israel is a small place.
7.5 million people.
8 million people.
8 million.
Now, about 50,000 of those illegal immigrants come from places in Africa, like Sudan, like Eritrea. And we basically, at the beginning, they used to make a very long way going from Eritrea through Sudan and through Egypt and crossing Sinai. At the time, we didn't have a fence between Sinai and Israel. Now we have. Now, this is a great challenge for us, as it is a great challenge for this country, United States, which is 10 times bigger than us. So don't be misled. We have one problem with illegal immigration, including from Africa. But as for Jewish people, white, black, yellow, red, you name it. Once you are a Jew, the state of Israel will absorb you as a citizen, as if you were born in the state of Israel.
I was talking with somebody that knew that I was going to be talking to you today, and they said, you know, let the audience know that if you go back to ancient times, there were Jews of African descent in the state of Israel going back to biblical times who now can trace today the lineage of
prophet.
Their great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandparents.
Amos, I should call you, the prophet Moses, who considered to be our biggest prophet, married a black wife, Tzipora. Mm. This you can find it in the Torah. So this goes 4,000 years way back.
239-1310. 239-1310 this afternoon. His name is. Let me go to Lewis. Got a question on politics in America and Israel. Hi, Lewis.
Hey, how you doing?
Fine.
Yes. You know, I don't know what the percentages of the Jewish community here is in America, but I know what the percentages is in our Senate and our House of Representatives. Why is it that when they swear on the Bible to hold and serve and protect the people of America, the United States of America, but most of their policies are geared toward Israel? And I don't have a problem with the issue. My issue is that hypocrisy in it when they say no country has the right to tell us how to run ours, but yet we're totally influenced by false politics in Israel. And when we vote people in the office, they don't mind on protecting Israel. They rather protect Israel more than they do their own American people here. My question is, like I heard one congressman say when Benjamin Netanyahu got to address the House and the Senate, that we wish we had him as a president instead of the one we stuck with. Why do they have more influence over us? I mean, they control so many parts of our American life here, be it Hollywood, be it sports agents, lawyers, judges, whatever. Why is it happening? Another people have such a small percentage in our country control right. Most of our country.
Let me let the Consul General respond to that. Do you all have all this influence? Because the argument could be said, if you had this influence, our Secretary of State wouldn't be over in Geneva talking with the Iranians.
Louis, I wanted to say as a joke that actually we have much more influence than you think. But the truth is that I wish what you say would have been true. Look, the Jewish community in the United States is about 2% of the population. I think 600 million Jews and 300 million Americans, give and take. So you're talking about 2% of the population. Indeed, Louis, we are very proud of what the Jewish community achieved in America in a very hard work. You know, those people came, many of them came from Europe after the war. But the relationship between Israel and America are not leaning only on the influence of the Jewish community in America. It is leaning on a very significant and strong relationship between the states. You know, Israel, I think, basically is the best protector of American interests all over the Middle East. Both states are leaning on a very strong moral infrastructure, democracy, human rights, women rights, your First Amendment, which calls for the freedom of media. So, indeed, the Jewish influence, if you want, in America is part of it. But this is not the only reason why the United States and America has such a good relationship. And again, as Amos just said, as much as we have good relationship between us and America, every now and then you have some misunderstanding, what we call in a diplomatic language hiccups. We iron those hiccups and we continue. For at the end of the day, Israel doesn't have any better friend than America. And I strongly believe that America doesn't have any better friend than Israel.
Did the government understand the loyalty and affinity that African Americans have for our president, Barack Obama? And when they see pictures, again, this is the media, when they see pictures of your prime minister and our president, and both of them kind of looking like, why are we here? and the media saying Prime Minister Netanyahu, he's sniping at the president, or the president is sniping at the prime minister, which may be just normal diplomatic give and take and signal sending and the things diplomats do. But to the average person listening or out on the street saying, you know, Why is he dissing our president? And it's similar to some of the behavior of the Russian president.
Oh, whoa.
You know, these kind of – because people – as you your nation would not, you know, like our president, you know, rolling eyes at your president or at your prime minister.
Let me tell you two things, Amos. First of all, indeed, as we speak now, Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Putin are meeting in Moscow. So by coincidence, they are sitting together. But, you know, when they sit together, I really don't think they discuss how to come across President Obama. That's not the issue. I guess they are discussing the Iranian challenge or maybe some other regional challenge. And again, I don't want to be judgmental as for the relationship with President Putin or President Obama. Let me tell you just only this. The relationship, the strategic relationship between Israel and the United States is a cornerstone in our strategic defense, in our national strategy. No personal relationship, bad as they might be, and I don't think they are bad. I think they are much more decent than people think. No personal relationship can erode those strategic relationship between the states. Look, President Obama, he has to take care of American interest. Mm-hmm. Prime Minister Netanyahu has to protect Israeli interest. In 95% of the cases, those interests go along. There are places where interests do not go along, and then both sides have to iron or bring to the table his own interest. Sorry. And we have to look for the common interest. Look, take for instance the Iranian challenge. Yeah. We all agree on the end zone, on the goal, on the next. I think we are on the same page. We have some differences concerning the tactics. If you want, I can speak about it later on. Look, but I wouldn't make out of it that there is any, God forbid, negative personal relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Obama. This is not.
Is it then more two good friends who sometimes like to speak frankly and bluntly? If I go back and look at the great prime ministers of Israel throughout the years, something tells me Golda Meir didn't mince words. Something tells me that Prime Minister Begin was not the type of person to mince words. We know Lyndon Johnson didn't mince words. We know Richard Nixon didn't mince words. We know that Ronald Reagan didn't mince words. So is it that we're looking – that people who normally – weren't interested in presidential politics now are into it because it's a historic president from my community's point of view, and they weren't around when maybe Golda Meir had it out with Lyndon Johnson, way going back in the day.
Yeah, look, I'm glad, Amos, you mentioned all those names because I'm a great scholar of the American-Israeli relationship because I think this is the most important relationship that we have as a state. And indeed, you mentioned President Lyndon Johnson. Actually, he really started this strategic relationship between Israel. Okay, President Kennedy, now we are 50 years for the assassination. President Kennedy identified already the importance of Israel, but it was really President Lyndon Johnson that gave really the push between him and the then Prime Minister Levi Eshkol. Look, during this time, from 1948, as you said, but mainly from 1963, President Johnson relationship have developed and reached one peak after the other. Obviously, when you're talking about 65 years of relationship, every now and then you have some hiccups, some hurdles, some difficulties. We had during Gerald Ford, what was known as the reassessment. Nobody remembers it anymore, but there was a crisis. Mm-hmm. Those problems, difficulties happened with Democrat presidents and Republican presidents, with left-wing in Israel and right-wing in Israel. The most important thing is to keep some distance from the hiccups here and there and to see that the relationship are excellent, and in the time of President Obama, they have reached new peaks.
239-1310, 239-1310. We're talking with Roei Gilad. He is the Consul General of the Midwest of the Nation of Israel. When we come back, we'll ask about Iran, because you don't trust him, I don't trust him. Chris don't trust him. And what we going to do? 239-1310. Afternoon's Day. Oh, at the top of the hour, the president of Indiana University, Dr. Michael McRobbie, will be here live. Who knew? See,
I can meet him here. I just met him yesterday.
You can meet him here. You're the warm-up.
We can make a summit
That's right. You're the warm-up guy. We'll be back with more after these. With Roei Gilad, the Israeli consul general, on Iran. You talked earlier that it is for your nation, you got to have ironclad guarantees that they don't have the capability of making a bomb. They're not making it in the back room. And to let anybody come in there, including representatives of your nation, to check on them?
Look, we pushed for a long time that the Iranians will understand that this is not in their best interest to have a nuclear bomb. I mean, when a nation calls to annihilate the other nation, to wipe them off the table, off the map, and at the same time try to develop the right technology to do this vision, to implement this vision, it makes us nervous. Now, obviously, indeed, now the West, the P5 plus one, are discussing with Iran. We're not against it. That has to be clear. We are for a diplomatic solution, provided it is a solution and not only a deal. Because we understand the Iranians are under pressure, and we say that's the time to reach, but not a deal, but to reach a solution. Mm-hmm. Such a solution that will prevent the Iranians to reach a nuclear bomb. As we speak now, they are very close to their aim, to their goal. And we have to roll it back. We have to push them back. I always say the best way to explain is to speak about a football game. Currently, the Iranians are 10 yards from the end zone.
You don't think they're that close?
Might be even closer. Might be even closer. And the only reason why they are not at the end zone yet is their political decision. Technologically, they are nearly there. They are what we call a threshold nuclear state. What we say, okay, you want to reach a deal, don't freeze them 10 yards from the end zone. Push them to the center of the court. If they are 50 yards from the end zone, we are okay. If they are 10 yards from the end zone and then we make a mistake, this might be the loudest touchdown that this world have heard for a long time.
Syria, they were not the greatest country in the world when they were stable,
to say the least.
And that was the country where you have no peace agreement if you got to be with them. Now it is a straight up civil war. Nobody knows who's winning that thing. And Assad is a very dangerous guy, and he's going to go out swinging. How serious a security threat is that? Because they hold the high ground with those Golan Heights.
Look, as you said, Syria was not a great neighbor before, and they are definitely not a great neighbor now. What we say is that First of all, what's happening in Syria, I think it's a great, it's a huge human tragedy. More than 100,000 people have been killed, assassinated in the course of 2 years. That's a tragedy. So every human being should feel very bad about what's happening in Syria. But against this background, really, you know, we have to choose between bad and bad. Current regime was an Iranian proxy just in the heart of the Middle East. They helped, or they have been the leeway, the way between Iran and the Hezbollah. All the Iranian weapon delivery to Hezbollah went through Syria. So if Syria is not there, if Bashar al-Assad is not there, so we believe that also Hezbollah will be gone, and that will serve an Israeli interest. However, we know also the opposition is having some elements that might pose a huge risk in the future of the Middle East. So what we say in a nutshell is the following. Mm-hmm. What's happening in Syria now is a domestic issue. This is none of our issue of problem. Let them settle down their problems. However, we need to make sure the first responsibility of the Israeli government is to make sure that there is security for the state of Israel. If indeed the situation in the Golan Heights will deteriorate, or the Syrian will try to send more advanced weapons to the Hezbollah under this cloud of civil war, Israel will make sure, as we did already, that this will not continue.
Let me go to Lydia right quick at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hi, I just wanted to thank the guests for coming on. And I just had a comment to the previous callers. I think we, as a nation, have to realize that God's word is true. Our Old Testament is correct with their Torah, that God will bless those who bless Israel, and he will curse those who curse Israel. And we have to remember that in our life, in our political realm, in our governmental system. That is, the word of God is fundamentally founded based upon that. That's how we live in this world. And so we always have to be an ally to Israel, regardless of whether we agree with their politics or not.
I appreciate it. Let me go to Karen right quick at 239-1310. Hi there.
Hi, Amos, and greetings to the guest speaker, the consulate. Yeah, I want to ditto what the previous caller said, that we do have to stand in support of Israel. And, you know, the word also says that, you know, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper that love thee. So it is a command that God has given us. But as well, you know, on a lighter note, some of us had noticed in the Miss Universe pageant that Israel had its first Miss Israel of African descent.
Yeah,
Wait. You mean Jeff didn't see the Miss Universe? Probably because Trump ran it.
You won't believe it. I had lunch with her. This is the first ever lunch I had with Miss. She's not Miss Universe. She's Miss Israel. Uh-huh. As we speak now, I think Karen, she's on her way to Russia for the Miss Universe competition. I must tell you, I had lunch with Miss Israel when she visited Chicago. There was only one problem. As much as I'm told, she's taller than I, and it doesn't happen to me very often that I meet women that are taller than me. But you are correct, Karen.
Sister.
She's a sister. She was born in Ethiopia.
Yeah.
She moved to Israel when she was an orphan at the age of 6 with her grandmother.
Mm. Yeah.
And she's been an officer in the Israeli army.
Uh-oh.
In the military police, out of all places. She's a student for administration and diplomacy, government and diplomacy, at the IDC, stands for Israeli Disciplinary Center in Herzliya. It's a very well-known college. And I wish her all the best. If she will be Miss Universe, we'll have a black Israeli Miss Universe that you can't get any better than that. So, and then I can say that I had lunch not only with Miss Israel, but with Miss Universe.
Well, you know, Consulate, the competition is actually over. It did already happen.
Oh, really? Sorry.
But we were so excited. We couldn't, you know, in a way we said it's about time, but then, you know, we were just so pleasantly surprised to see her. in the competition as Miss Israel and representing the, and then when I read, you know, what you had said confirms what you said, that she was an orphan. Not only was she an orphan, but she actually served the country in the military.
Look, Karen, let me tell you this. There might be more beautiful women during the competition, but for me, she was the most beautiful.
Wow.
Beauty wonderful. Like she has internal beauty nobody else has.
All right, thank you. See the things we learn on this program.
Indeed.
You all have a website. If people want to know more information about your country, how do they find it?
Just Google Israeli Consulate to the Midwest, and then it will come up.
It is an honor and privilege to have you on the program. See the things that we're learning on the program? Roy Gilead, the Consul General of the Midwest, of the state of – I was calling it a nation, but it's the state of Israel. See, I should have read my report from the CIA. But then the CIA only has your population at 7.7. So, see, they know they got better information than the CIA. They've always had better information.
The CIA update their website as far as once a year. And, you know, we multiply fast.
You got – that's because they know everything. They know everything. Thank you very, very much for being with us. When we come back, IU is in the house. The president of Indiana University, Dr. Michael McRobbie, coming up next. This afternoon with Amos after these.